You are listening to a session recorded live at the 2010 AAAS Annual Meeting, held February 18th through the 22nd in San Diego, California. Now to our session.
Afternoon. I'm Art Bettis, and my co-organizers, Paul Birch and Nick Lancaster, would like to welcome you to the Dust in the Earth System Symposium. We've got a nice lineup of speakers this afternoon. We're going to cover quite a range of things having to do with dust, and I'd like to just sort of preface this by saying what we think dust is or what we're talking about this afternoon with regard to dust. It's a certain size range of things usually, anywhere from about a micron to about 50 microns, or clay to medium silt size, depending upon where you are. Or it's also called mineral aerosol. Okay, all aerosols are not dust, but we're talking about mineral aerosols. Okay, so if you're an aerosol person, that's what we're going to be talking about today. Before we get going, I'd like to thank the National Academies. There are four of the committees that have sponsored this and made this possible, really. The Quaternary Research, Geological Science, Soil Science, and Geodesy and Geophysics Committees, the National Academy, National Academies of Science, sponsored this and ran things through. And I'd especially like to thank Esther Steins, who really made this happen through various sorts of lobbying and keeping us going and keeping us on track. So with that, I'd like to get going, since we have a lot to do here. And our first speaker is Karen Kofel. She's from Simon Fraser University, and she's going to give us an overview of dust in the Earth system.
Thanks very much, Art. And thanks very much to the organizers. This is really a good opportunity for us dust folk to get together and talk about dust's importance in an interdisciplinary fashion. Hi. So what I'd like to do is present an overview of dust and how its importance in the Earth system in the past, in the present, and what we think is happening in the future, or what we don't really know about what's happening in the future. But to emphasize Art's point from just a minute ago, I'd like to reemphasize this notion of what we're talking about, or specifically what I'm talking about when I mention dust. Dust actually is kind of a hodgepodge of particles when we think about it. It has a bunch of living things in it. It has fungal spores and pollen in it. It also has combustion products in it. But what I'm referring to when I talk about dust are soil mineral fragments, so quartz and feldspars, and also clay minerals. And to reemphasize what Art just says, the size range we're talking about here are submicron to on the order of 100 microns size, and a little smaller than 100 microns in size. And to put that into perspective, think about the diameter of a human hair is on the order of about 20 to 25 microns in size. So to put this in geologic perspective, I'm showing a slide here of changes in temperature, carbon dioxide, and dust that have been recorded in the Antarctic ice cores. So these are records that are going back 800,000 years, so 800,000 up to the present today. And one of the things that these records have shown us, they're amazing records of changes in climate, and they reveal really strong correlations between temperature and carbon dioxide. Well, particles of dust also have been measured in the ice cores, and one of the things that they reveal is a really interesting type of feedback or sort of response of dust within the climate system. So whenever we see all these, this is really hard to hold still, see these gray-shaded regions, these are ice ages, past ice age periods, and one of the things you note from that is that during ice ages, we see increases in dust in the ice cores. Now, this isn't an isolated place. I mean, Antarctica is quite isolated, but it's one point on the globe, but this phenomenon is not isolated. We see these changes in dust in ocean sediments in the Pacific and other parts of the ocean, and in terrestrial deposits on land. We see this type of glacial-interglacial variability in dust. So if we step now from that 800,000-year timescale up to a more recent timescale for geologists, I'm showing here two different timescales of dust variability. The figure on the left is from the western interior of the United States, And this is on a log plot, so 10,000 years is over here on the right. And as we move forward, one of the things that this record's revealed is a 500-fold increase in dust deposition in this particular site. So we see large changes in dust deposition. When we move to this site on the Antarctic Peninsula, we also see, over the last two centuries, changes in deposition of dust. So the point that I'd like to make is that now that we're in the present, dust isn't static. We can see not just temporal shifts, we can also see lots of interannual variability and trends in dust. So, again, these are just two sites and not representative of the entire globe, but nevertheless, we see that dust is changing today. So what I'd like to do is to put dust in the perspective of the Earth system. Dust is actually, it's sort of kind of the great communicator in the Earth system. It's the guy you want to have at the party because he links land, air, sea, and climate together. So on the land, that's where dust is produced. Once it's in the air, it can affect climate. Once it's deposited on the sea, it can actually fertilize phytoplankton in the ocean. And all of these things have feedbacks between climate and these other regions of the Earth system. So first I'd like to talk about land and specifically dust emissions. Globally, almost about 2 billion tons of dust is removed from the surface and transported via wind in the atmosphere every year. And this is a satellite photo. It's sort of an average put together by Ingolstadt and Washington showing where the bright orange and red areas are showing regions of hot spots or areas where dust is emitted today. Now, most of these hot spots, when we look at the area underneath those positions, underneath those little points that are on that graph, they're associated with lake, fluvial, and dune deposits. And in fact, the majority of them, those hot spots, are associated or found in North Africa and the Middle East. So that's where we're seeing most of the global dust being produced today. I should point out that there are other sources of dust being produced in Asia and Australia, in the South American and North American continents as well. But again, the major sources are found in North Africa and in the Middle East. So when we think about what's actually controlling those dust emissions, there are several factors. First, there are the characteristics of the land surface. How moist is the soil? How much is available? And part of that characterization of the land surface includes vegetation cover. When we have a large vegetation cover, we don't have a lot of dust emission. And that vegetation cover is controlled by several factors, like changes in temperature and precipitation, and also CO2. So a CO2 fertilization effect, for example, where CO2 actually makes vegetation in semi-arid regions better able to adapt to water stress, for example. And so they may become more stable in higher CO2 concentrations. Another control on dust emissions are surface winds. And a lot of these factors can change with climate. We also have human factors like changes in land use. Cultivation and rangeland on the land surface, and also what I've called infrastructure changes. You can think of that as construction or road production. That can also affect changes in dust emissions. So when we think about the last glacial period, I'm going to consider the land, air, and sea components. And what I'm going to do first is talk about what we know about the last ice age, what we know about the present, and what we project is going to occur in the future. So when we think about dust emissions and we think about those controls on dust emissions, one of the things that we see is that several of those factors that are controlling dust emissions were changed during the last glacial period. We saw changes in temperature. It was cooler. We saw large changes in precipitation in the hydrological cycle. CO2 concentrations we know were about 80 to 100 parts per million lower than the pre-industrial values. Surface winds were different, and our vegetation covers were different. This is a satellite photo coming out of Alaska from the Copper River showing another factor at glacial times. This is from today, but applied to glacial times, and that is that glaciogenic processes, glacial grinding, produces this very fine flour. So you can see coming out of that river basin the whiteness of this dust. It's sort of this glacial flour. And there was, when you have two large ice sheets or massive ice sheets like we did during the Ice Age, we saw this process being more active during the last glacial period. So what's the end result? If we've over the last 10 years of modeling and putting together data sets, what we've seen is that, in fact, the deposition rates of dust during the last ice age were approximately globally 3 times greater than they are today. And this is, as you can see from this figure down here, that of course those changes were variable. We saw 2 to 20 times greater dust deposition at the poles, and maybe lower deposition rates in the tropical regions. Lesser increases in dust. So what happened? Well, dust source areas were expanded just because of those reasons that I mentioned, due to changes in vegetation cover and winds and these glacial sources. And a recent study in 2006 by Natalie Mahowald and colleagues was able to infer that these glaciogenic sources increased that dust load approximately by just over about 55%. So I think the difference was without these glaciogenic sources, dust in their simulations was about 2 times greater than today, and by including them, the changes increased to a little bit over 3 times what they are today. So we have these factors playing out at the last glacial period. What happens when we start to consider the future? Well, we have those same factors influencing dust emissions. When we think about them in terms of the complications of three overlying fundamental forcings that are changing. First of all, we always have natural climate change going on and the resultant changes in land surfaces. We also see lots of human-induced changes in land use. And this figure here is showing the changes in land use that have been estimated between 1750 and 1990. And so we can see large changes in land use that have already occurred, and these are likely to occur in the future as well. And then we also see human-induced changes in climate that are being superimposed on this as well. And these climate changes are likely to influence dust emissions. Well, how are they going to influence them? Is a little bit up in the air at the moment. I'm showing here the results from 4 simulations of a future time periods in which model simulations were looking at the climate-induced effects on dust emissions. And one of the things that you see is that in the top 2 simulations, they're predicting decreases in dust emissions into the future. The bottom 2 simulations are predicting large increases in dust emissions into the future. So, and these are just looking at the globally averaged numbers and not even considering the regional differences within these simulations. And as we look in more detail, we would find even greater differences. So, basically, my point is that our knowledge of what is going to happen with dust emissions in the future, it still remains rather uncertain. I'd like to move now to talk about dust once it is in the air, or changes in the radiative forcing of dust. Now, radiative forcing is really giving us an idea about the net energy balance on the planet. And so if I talk about a positive radiative forcing, I'm talking about an impact that's warming the system. If I mention a negative radiative forcing, I'm talking about cooling. And this is sort of a nice figure that demonstrates how dust can create both of those effects regionally. In the areas where we see dust is moving over the ocean, over the dark ocean surface, the dust appears more reflective. So we can see that in these instances, in the most general sense, dust is more likely to have a cooling effect. In areas where the dust is moving over top of the cloud layers, it actually is making the surface darker, and it would have more of an absorbing effect and therefore warming. So because of the regional patterns in dust, you can imagine that there are large regional impacts of dust on radiative forcing. But what I'd like to do first of all here is talk about some simulations at the last glacial maximum that has tried to look at the impacts of ice age dust at the top of the atmosphere. Now, remember I already just showed that dust deposition rates were about threefold higher than today. So these should have impacts on the radiative forcing. I'm showing 2 simulations here, one from Claquin et al. And one from Mahowald et al. 2006. Now, In both cases, blue is showing negative radiative forcing or cooling. There are several important spatial differences in the patterns in these simulations, but what I'd like to get at is the globally averaged effect here. Both of them show very close to a negative 1 watt per meter square average cooling globally. Now, the largest impacts in both of these simulations is occurring in the tropics. And of these two simulations, Natalie Mahawald's actually looked at that impact on surface temperatures. And in that simulation, they saw an average surface temperature cooling of about 0.85 degrees Celsius as a result of the dust, the change in dust in the atmosphere. So what do we know about dust today? I'd like to just talk about the direct radiative forcing of effects of dust, of the total loading of dust in the atmosphere. And by that, I mean both the combined natural and what we think is the anthropogenic portions of mineral dust. And what I've put up here are the estimates from 2001 and 2007. And one of the interesting things we see is that between those two time periods in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we see that our estimates of the radiative impact of dust has gotten slightly more negative. So overall, we think that the simulation sort of shifted more towards the negative, suggesting more of a cooling. But in fact, the uncertainty range remains the same at about 2 watts per meter squared. The reason for these large uncertainties are that we still have several uncertainties about the optical properties of dust. And we're also uncertain about how dust is distributed, where exactly, pinpointing the exact emission locations and the fluxes, and the exact controls on vertical transport and deposition. We still have several of these uncertainties, and these are what tend to be leading to these wide ranges in the model simulations. So, as you might imagine, this makes predicting the radiative impact of dust in the future even more difficult. I'm showing the results from two simulations, looking at the changes between 2100 and the year 2000. Now, when you look at the globally averaged radiative impact, first of all, one of the things we see is they're very similar and they're very small. However, if you look in more detail at these simulations, you see that the reasons for getting these numbers is entirely different. In the first study in Mahawald et al. 2006, this positive forcing, radiative forcing into the future is because of a less negative top of the atmosphere forcing, and this is due to reduced dust emissions. On the contrary, in the other model simulations, it saw a fivefold increase in positive top of the atmosphere forcing due to increased dust emissions. So we're seeing a similar answer here of small magnitude for entirely different regions and with very large regional impacts. As a note, in the Woodward et al. Simulation, one of the things that we see is a dramatic change to the Amazon rainforest. I think it's completely destroyed in that simulation. So I'd like to move on and talk about dust as a nutrient. We can think about dust as impacting not just radiative forcing of climate, but it can also have play as a feedback within the climate system by impacting the ocean, changing levels of fertilization in the ocean and changing the productivity of phytoplankton and therefore also the uptake of atmospheric CO2. So dust is kind of like a multivitamin. It has iron, silica, phosphate, and nitrate in it. And what I'm showing here in the top right is a satellite picture of one of the iron experiments in which iron was taken out and dumped onto the ocean. And you see that little green sickle shape there. That's actually the satellite the imprint of that iron experiment from the satellites. Now, why is this important? It's because there are regions in the world, if you look at the bottom left figure, regions of the world where we have lots of nutrients but low chlorophyll production. So there's excessive nutrients that could be used up by phytoplankton in the ocean, and therefore there's a potential for them to draw down atmospheric CO2. So this was a point that was brought up by John Martin way back in the late 80s. That I think over a beer he once said, if you give me enough dust, I'll give you an ice age. And, in fact, we do know during the glacial times we had higher dust. We had higher deposition of dust on the oceans. So one of the things that we could look at is what the impact of that dust might be. And the bottom right corner here is showing a compilation, again, a data model comparison of the impact of dust on productivity in the ocean compared with reconstructions of ocean productivity. And what that map is showing us is that, indeed, when dust is increased over the ocean, in this model simulation, we see increased carbon export to the seafloor and lower atmospheric CO2. Now, one point about that simulation, though, is that the total effect of dust was on the order of about 15 parts per million. Now, the total glacial interglacial change in atmospheric CO2 is on the order of 80 to 100 parts per million. So dust has a significant effect. It also has a limited effect. So if we think about that in terms of other changes in the ocean, we see here glacial interglacial changes in dust on that order of 80 to 100 parts per million. And here we see that impact of iron fertilization from dust. So it is a significant driver, but a limited driver of dust, of CO2 changes. When we look into the future, I'm showing you a simulation from Pyle Perek et al., and what they have shown is, in fact, if we look in an ocean iron cycle model, one of the things that we see is that even if we increase dust fivefold, or the influx of dust and iron to the ocean fivefold, we see about an 8 parts per million decrease in atmospheric CO2. And if we decrease the amount of dust landing on the atmosphere by landing on the ocean by about 50%, we see a plus 14 parts per million increase in atmospheric CO2. In other words, a positive feedback. And so basically, we expect that there would be an impact from iron fertilization, but this particular simulation suggests that it's going to have a limited impact, and that's consistent with the glacial interglacial data. Mind you, there are still many open questions about this. A lot of those simulations use constant solubility of iron, and one of the things we know is that the solubility of iron has a very large range in actuality, and so new simulations are actually looking at this. We also know that there are a lot more complications a lot more complexities to the iron cycle than are currently put in iron cycle models. And so this is another factor that could be included. And like any other part of studying dust, the regional impacts can be much larger than some of the global averages that I'm showing you. So with that, I'd like to conclude with these statements. Dust has varied in the past, and it's going to vary in the future, and it will have impacts on the radiative forcing and ocean biogeochemistry. There is, however, quite a lot that we don't know. Even though we've provided some first-order answers to some questions about the dust cycle, there are still many questions that remain, and I covered these in my talk. And also, I think that the future is still quite a bit wide open. We have several factors that are changing, and we haven't quite constrained how those changes are going to affect the dust cycle and its feedbacks. So thank you very much. Your question is that if the major sources are in North Africa and the Middle East today, why are I didn't quite understand.
Well, the factor three difference in the dust emission.
Right.
Why would North Africa be impacted by?
Well, that glacial emissions, glaciogenic sources, are really only one part of the picture, because we also see impacts of vegetation changes and changes in winds as well. So if we have changes in the hydrological cycle during the glacial period, we see actually an expansion of those glacial sources around the edges of the deserts in North Africa, and we see a large impact of winds in that area as well. So there are other factors that are contributing to those increases.
Our next speaker is going to move from the air to the ground, and it's Dan Moose, the U.S. Geological Survey, is going to talk to us about geologic record of dust. Good afternoon and welcome to everyone. Thanks for coming. I'll talk a little bit about some of the things that Karen just touched on in the previous talk and bring it down to the earth, as Art put it, and talk about the geologic archives, if you will, or the geologic, as I describe it there, record of dust. And what I'll talk about here is how we find archives of past periods of dust deposition and what they tell us, and how we get at them in terms of understanding the possible effects of dust on climate. So let's move forward here with this. That one won't work, and we will... How about that one? There we go. And just a quick thanks to Art Bettis for organizing all of this. Art has been a partner with me in a lot of studies of the geologic archives of dust in much of North America, from Alaska here all the way down into the southern Mississippi Valley. So thanks for organizing this, Art. Geologic records of dust are found over much of the Earth's surface, both on the land and in the oceans. And I've identified here what I consider to be five broad groups of places. One of them is on ice sheets themselves. We have some excellent records, and Karen showed you an example of one from Antarctica, where we can actually look at dust records through time and cores taken in ice sheets. We can do the same thing at the deep ocean floor, where we can see dust that has settled to the ocean bottom and see it change through time, and in lake cores as well. And in deposits that are composed virtually entirely of dust deposits, or what we call LUS deposits, which includes not only long-range transported fine-grained materials, but coarser-grained materials that have traveled a shorter distance. And finally, we can find exotic minerals in soils sometimes that tell us that we have impacts of long-range transported dust in soils where it is not as immediately apparent, and we have to use some clever techniques to try to tease out what component of the soil is derived from dust. What are the sources of dust? And Karen mentioned this as well. I'll show you some of the examples of what we call both non-glacial sources of dust and glaciogenic sources of dust. And our non-glacial sources of dust, many of these are found in desert regions. But there are some exceptions to that, and there's a very important one from here in North America that I'll talk about a little bit later. But a lot of our presently active sources of dust, such as those that we were just alluding to a few minutes ago in North Africa, are particles that are generated in geomorphic settings like these, in large dune fields like the Grande Orientale here in Algeria and Tunisia, in places, favorable conditions of playas or old lake beds,
particularly where we have sand dunes from dune fields like these that impact on those surfaces, and particularly from dry washes like these coming out of the Atlas Mountains, again in Algeria and Tunisia, where we have a lot of sediments that are pre-sorted, loose, unconsolidated, and that can be further entrained, but by wind. But one of the major players, as Karen pointed out, during the last glacial period was the expanded ice sheets in North America, Eurasia, South America, where we had a very efficient production of rock flour by glaciers, such as is occurring today still in the Alaska Range. And you can see a big dust storm developing. Here it is as a close-up in the Delta River bed, which is drained by or drains the Alaska Range. And if you follow it on down, here it is starting to bury this boreal forest just east of there. And there is Art Bettis's hand on the ground showing what was just deposited earlier that day by this very dust storm. So this is a process that we can see in action in places where we still have glaciers like Alaska and where this was occurring to a much greater extent with large ice sheets that covered the continents during the last glacial period. We can sometimes see a combination of both glacial and non-glacial sources of dust. And here's a nice example, I think, from the Taklamakan Desert in China, where we have glaciers up here in the mountain ranges that rim this basin. And the basin itself is covered by a large dune field. So we can get silt particle production by glacial grinding up here in the mountains. It can be transported by streams or fluvial transports to the basin. It can then get picked up by the wind and can be added to by a diminution of sand-sized particles in the dune field, and that gets added to the mix, and then it can be deposited right back up on the mountains again where it started out. So this is an interesting cycle of sedimentary, kind of a sedimentary cascade that illustrates how we can have both glacial and non-glacial sources of dust, even within the same basin. But to go back for a moment to this issue of glacial effects and how dust production was enhanced during glacial periods, here's the present state of glacial ice and large ice sheets in North America. We still have the large Greenland ice sheet here, but the Laurentide ice sheet, which covered the eastern part of North America, and the Cordilleran ice sheet, which covered the western part, are very much smaller today. The Cordilleran ice sheet is gone completely, and the Laurentide ice sheet is limited to the Barnes Ice Cap on Baffin Island. So during the last glacial period, the glacial grinding that was possible from these two big ice sheets was much greater than what it is at the present time, and that generated a tremendous amount of silt-sized sediment. Interestingly enough, a lot of our best records, as I mentioned, of that period of time is in the remaining ice sheets. And so in the Antarctic ice sheet and in Greenland, we have some of our best archives of past episodes of dust deposition during that glacial period. Here's an example. This is very similar to the curve that Karen showed you from Dome C. This is the EPICA group that did the coring here. This is a brilliant piece of work going back, as Karen pointed out, almost 800,000 years. And we see very high fluxes of dust here, as you can see by this series of yellow peaks during glacial periods that are faithfully recorded here in the Delta D record that is also present in the ice in that core. So in the southern hemisphere, where we didn't even have the large ice sheets that we had growing during last glacial time in the northern hemisphere, we still have a great increase in the amount of dust during glacial periods. It's a very similar record for Greenland, although it only goes back to the last interglacial period, and just barely back into that. But we see the same kind of thing, increased flux of dust during the last glacial period in Greenland. We have other archives as well. I mentioned lakes being excellent sources of dust traps and dust archives. One of the best ones has resulted from dust that comes off of China and Mongolia crosses over into Korea and into Japan and then on into the Pacific. And what I'm going to do is show you a lake record from Japan that covers the last interglacial glacial cycle, about the last 140,000 years. This is the oxygen isotope record showing the present interglacial, the late last glacial, an interstadial, the early last glacial, the last interglacial complex, and then finally the penultimate glacial. And you can see the highest dust fluxes shown here in red in Lake Biwa in Japan right here are during the glacial periods, both the late last glacial, the early last glacial, and the penultimate glacial. So we're seeing in the northern hemisphere lake records the same kind of thing that we see in the ice records of Greenland and Antarctica. And if we continue farther offshore to the east, out into the Pacific, even as much as 2,000 kilometers to the east, the deep sea record records similar changes. That last slide just showed you the last interglacial glacial cycle here. Here we're going to take it all the way back to about the last five glacial interglacial cycles. And you can see here that the dust flux, again, is highest during our glacial periods each time here and lower during interglacial periods. And that happens to match the Chinese lust record here, too. What is shown in yellow here are periods of lust deposition or windblown silt. Brown are periods of soil formation when the landscape was stable, not receiving much material, and soils could develop. And our periods of dust flux that produce lust deposits are the same things that produce the high sediment loads in Lake Biwa, and as you go farther offshore into the Pacific, the high dust loads onto the deep sea floor. So all of these records are showing us a similar kind of thing of much greater dust fluxes during glacial periods. And it's not limited to the Pacific. And Joe Prospero, one of our speakers later on here, is going to be talking about a long dust trap record. I think that's a high dust level warning siren. So be careful. At any rate, he's going to be talking here about transatlantic dust transport, and I won't go into that very much except to say that here's a good example of it coming all the way across here to the Caribbean region. And with Joe, we've been able to document that soils on a lot of places where you wouldn't expect much in the way of soil development, limestone surfaces, real hard volcanic rock surfaces, and so on, we find evidence in all these places with the red dots of some of Joe's African dust being a significant to dominant component of the soil material. What are we doing on time? Because this timer isn't going. I'm doing good? Okay. I'll leave it at that. So that brings us to lust deposits and their sort of archive. And lust is a deposit that a lot of people don't realize is present on landscapes that they are looking at, but it covers much of the mid-continent of North America, much of South America, particularly Argentina, much of Eurasia, and particularly much of China. All these areas shown in yellow here. It's windblown silt, and it covers about 10% of the Earth's surface, something on that order. A significant part of it, many of our most productive soils developed in lust deposits, and it is a windblown silt. Now, in some places where we have dramatic dust storms, but actually very small net accumulations, like parts of the Middle East here, what we can see recorded as the geologic archive is a series of lust deposits, which are brown here, soils that have high calcium carbonate that are white here, through time. These numbers here are ages and thousands of years, Ka for kiloanno. And you can see this is a record that goes back about 170,000 years in a succession of lust deposits, buried soils, with this kind of a net accumulation over time. So the last glacial period is basically this upper part here. So we have a long, detailed record here, but relatively small amounts of net dust accumulation. If we move into the glacial country of North America, this is what was deposited just in the period from about 28,000 years ago to about 12,000 years ago. Northern Illinois, about 16 meters of it here. Near Art Bettis' hometown, 40 meters of this stuff deposited just within about 12 to 15,000 years during the last glacial period. Okay, enormous fluxes of dust Some of it, short-distance transport, but enormous fluxes of dust in a very short period of time. Now, a lot of this is from these glacial effects, the glacial grinding from the Laurentide ice sheet, and then meltwaters down the major river systems like these, the Ohio, Mississippi, and Missouri, carried a lot of this silt down. It was deposited on the floodplains, blown into these huge loess deposits. But notice that over here, where we have these darker, redder colors, the loess is actually thicker in areas that are upstream and upwind of where these glacial deposits were found. It turns out that the major source for a lot of this loss is actually a non-glacial material. It's a volcaniclastic siltstone of the White River group, what we see in the South Dakota Badlands. Okay, it's pre-made siltstone, very loose, very weathered, easily deflated under the right conditions. And this is what blanketed much of Nebraska, Kansas, Colorado during the last glacial period. And it's even thicker than what we see in the glacial country. Here's about 16 meters of it in a place called Eustis, Nebraska. Bignell Hill, Nebraska, just south of the city of North Platte, 47 meters of loess deposited during the last glacial period. That is a world record. That we are trying to get this into Guinness as the world record thickest last glacial loess deposit. So this is from non-glacial sources. Now, what's interesting is the timing is no different than what we see in the glacial country. This is the approximate glacial loess, non-glacial loess boundary. To it, the Missouri River, where our speaker or our organizer, Art Bettis, grew up near Sioux City, Iowa. That boundary sort of separates the non-glacial loess realm from the glacial loess realm. The timing is the same. We've dated all of these sites that you see here in red, or somebody has. They all come out around 28,000 to 12,000 years. And this goes back to what Karen was mentioning. A lot of this has to do with not only more glacial silt from glacial sources, but the right climatic conditions that are not supply related, but are related to factors that enhance the availability of silt and its ability to be transported. So in conclusion, we have lots of geologic records of dust deposition in a wide variety of archives. They span the geosphere, hydrosphere, cryosphere, and even the pedosphere. Our soil records, ice core records, lake core records, all of these all indicate greatest dust deposition during glacial periods, especially the last one. And last glacial loess records have the same age range, regardless of whether the loess is glacial or non-glacial. That suggests, as Karen mentioned also, we probably had a variety of climate-related factors that enhanced this. Stronger winds, possibly drier climates, possibly less vegetation cover, and possibly a decreased intensity of the hydrologic cycle, fewer rain-out periods so that dust could actually be transported farther. So this extraordinary situation of a very dusty last glacial planet must have had profound effects on the overall radiation balance, ocean fertilization, soils, and ecosystems. Thank you very much. That's a good question. The question was about exposed continental shelves during last glacial periods. This is something that's an area that is very ripe for study. A lot of study has been done showing that a lot of shelves were sources of dunes during the last glacial period. And there's been a fair amount of effort done on that. Very little has been done on finer grain sediments and their possible sources. Some places like around in Indonesia, the Sunda Shelf, and some of these areas would have been huge areas that could have provided sediment. No one has investigated this to any significant degree, so this needs to be done. Right.
The question is,
yeah.
If you consider
Yeah. It's a good question, and I think Natalie has done some work on this, and because we've done some of the situations where we've taken the fluxes in these areas, and then knowing what the particle size distribution is, taking just the fine grain component, and you might be talking about this later here. No, she will not be talking about that later today. However, she has done this, and that paper that Karen was citing of Natalie's from 2006 shows that there some of this stuff could have traveled quite far. And I hope I'm not misinterpreting you here. No. Okay. All right. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, our next speaker is Natalie Mahomald, who you've already heard about from a few times. She's at Cornell University, and Natalie is going to take us sort of between the two here a little bit with some models. And
thanks for coming this afternoon, and thanks to Art and Nick and others for organizing this. This is a fun thing to do. There are so many really interesting sessions here at AAAS, so thanks for coming to this session. I'm going to talk today, I titled it Dust in the Anthropocene here, whereas it's Dust in Earth System Models in the program, and it'll be both to some extent. I primarily work with climate models, but with data model intercomparisons, and so I've had the pleasure to work with both Karen and Dan, as well as Joe, of your speakers, because in formulating a model, it's so important to compare to observations, and I guess I should talk a little bit more about the formulation of a model, which I didn't put into the slides today. The type of model that I'm working with here are actually models that are related to numerical weather prediction models. So they're the pretty high resolution, maybe low resolution. But they cover the entire globe. They have a three-dimensional models. We normally model dust as four size bins because the sizes matter so much in the atmosphere. And the models we work with also have a three-dimensional ocean as well as a land surface as well. These are fully coupled models used for the IPCC process. And at every point that we compare to available observations. This is a very detailed and hard process, and this is why I usually work with observationalists to try to make sure we're interpreting the observational data to the best we can. And we also put in our best understanding of what the processes are that are important. And in a sense, those are hypotheses or working formulations of how we think the processes are important. But at some point, it comes down to assumptions because the dust in the Earth system is not that well known. There are large uncertainties. And again, we go back and we compare to observations when available, but there are limited observations. I'm not going to talk very much today about our comparisons to observations. I'm going to talk a little bit more about processes and the feedbacks in the system. And one of the reasons to go through all the trouble to build a dust model after you have all these great observations is to get at feedback processes and trying to pull apart what processes are important. And you can't really do that using the observations just because we only have one system. It's not like a lab, in a chemistry lab, where you can go in and do a control experiment and a real experiment. We only have one system. We only have one Earth. And so a model allows you to pull apart the processes, in the model anyway. And if the model is an accurate representation of the real system, then it provides insight into the real system. What I'm going to present today, I mostly list my collaborators on the unpublished part of the study, which I might get to, we'll see. This work is done in collaboration with a lot of different people in a lot of different fields. As Karen mentioned, desert dust has important interactions with climate biogeochemistry. The dust impacts on climate are through direct interactions in the shortwave as well as the longwave. So dust actually acts like a greenhouse gas you can think of too, as well as the shortwave interactions that Karen talked about. In addition, dust can operate as a cloud condensation nuclei or as an ice formation nuclei. I'm not really going to talk about those feedbacks. Those type of feedbacks are very uncertain, and they also are active for anthropogenic aerosols as well and are certain for those. In addition, dust has impacts on biogeochemistry, and Karen talked a bit about the iron fertilization process in dust, and I'll talk some more about that. There's also phosphorus in dust, which may fertilize tropical rainforests in other regions, and Oliver Chadwick will talk more about that. If we take a look at a distribution of aerosol optical depth from a particular satellite instrument for a particular time period, we get a sense of how potentially important dust is. I want to point out that aerosol optical depth is, you could think of the gunk in the atmosphere, the aerosols in the atmosphere, and how they're interacting with the shortwave. That's basically what aerosol optical depth is. And you can see here in this image for this particular season that the largest plume of desert dust over the oceans, I should point out this satellite can only see over oceans, it can't see over land. It comes off of North Africa, so that's desert dust combined with biomass burning. And the next most large plume there is the Arabian Sea, which again is desert dust combined with anthropogenic aerosols. And this is just to emphasize the importance of desert dust for radiative forcing. Karen talked and Dan talked a lot about the glacial interglacial variability in dust, so I don't have to talk about this very much. The main point is that dust varies with climate. We know that from the paleo data record. In addition, dust varies in our own climate. I'm showing here the dust record at Barbados that Joe Prospero and his colleagues have collected. And I'd like to, I think he's going to talk about this too, but I'm going to need to provide a little background on this to talk about some of my work. And the red line is the Barbados dust record. So Barbados is downwind from North Africa. So this is North African dust transported across the North Atlantic. And so this is a combination of a change in the sources over North Africa along with changes in transport. But we see a four-fold change in dust over a large region. We can also see this in the qualitative data that we have over North Africa, a very large change in dust over North Africa. And that up until the about 1990, it's very well correlated with the Sahel precipitation. So the precipitation in the region between the Sahara and the rainforests of Africa. And so there are large variability in desert dust. And if you think about the variability from the glacial interglacial, where dust changed by a factor of 3, or this regional variability in desert dust, these are some of the largest changes in constituents in the atmosphere that we see. It's much larger than the change in CO2, for example. These are really large changes in desert dust that we're seeing regionally as well as globally in the glacial interglacial cycle. Well, it seems unlikely, given the climate change that we've seen over the last 100 years, that dust is not changing. In addition, as Karen talked about, human land use could be perturbing dust. So there's a lot of different mechanisms for human climate change, natural climate change, and human land use to be modifying dust. But we don't actually know what the net impact is. And here I'm showing a summary of the available data, which is the ratio of dust deposition at, about 10 different locations on the planet from current climate over the pre-industrial. And you can see that in some places dust is bigger and in some places dust is smaller. And even in a place like the Andes, at one core it's increased and one core it's decreased. So there's not a lot of consistency then in the available data. And I just want to point out with something with a lifetime of desert dust, which is about, say, a couple days to 2 weeks in the atmosphere, you can't just look at the ice cores like you can for CO2, which has a much longer lifetime. You really have to have data over many different locations on the planet. So this number of data that we have here is far too limited in order for us to say what's happening in the Anthropocene over the time period from the 1850s to the current. So next, I want to talk about what do changes in dust do to the climate and biogeochemistry. So the first place I want to focus on, again, is the North African changes in dust that we saw between the 1980s and the 1960s, where the dust went up fourfold at Barbados. If we stick this in a model and we take a look at what dust does in the model, it generally cools in the atmosphere. And a cooling in the atmosphere will cause a downward motion in the atmosphere, which suppresses precipitation, generally speaking. And so over North Africa, there's a little bit of a suppression of precipitation, and basically the precipitation is moved southward. And in fact, in our model simulations, the Sahel drought was to a large extent forced by the ocean, consistent with other studies, but also had a large feedback from the dust particles themselves. Once you get the atmosphere dusty, it pushes the precipitation farther into the southern hemisphere, reduces the dust or the precipitation over the Sahel region. So in our study, the dust impacts on the Sahel was responsible for perhaps 30% of the decrease in precipitation in that region. So again, in this case, I think similar to what Karen was saying, the dust is not the primary forcer here, but the dust plays an important role in the regional climate. I'm going to come to the iron in oceans that Karen Kofeld also mentioned. She talked about this a little bit, that iron is a micronutrient that's required by you and I as well as ocean phytoplankton. It's required in very small quantities. There is iron in all crustal material, and therefore it's in the dust particles. The atmospheric deposition of iron is an important source to open ocean regions. As she mentioned, the high nutrient, low chlorophyll regions are probably related to iron limitation. There's plenty of other nutrients there. There's plenty of light. They can't grow because they don't have the iron. As she mentioned, the dustiness in the LGM could be responsible for the drawdown of CO2. I would agree with her that it's maybe between 10 and 30% of the signal that you need is what you're getting just simply from the changes in dust from our best estimates these days. Something else that I forgot to put on this slide is that the iron that's brought in with the dust has been related by some oceanographers to a change in the change in the nitrogen-fixing organisms as well, that nitrogen-fixing organisms have higher iron requirements than other organisms. So that would relate iron deposition from the atmosphere in the oceans to the nitrogen cycle in the oceans. And for the most part, most of the ocean is nitrogen-limited. And so then you're really feeding back on the ocean productivity if you can impact the nitrogen cycle. The second thing to talk about is that not all iron is bioavailable. And again, Karen mentioned this a little bit. We think that about 2% of the iron is bioavailable, but it's highly spatially heterogeneous. We also think that atmospheric processing may create more bioavailable iron. And this is because of the acidity in the atmosphere making the iron more soluble, more bioavailable. And I'd like to point out that humans are increasing the acidity of the atmosphere. Acid rain is not something that's over. Humans, through the release of combustion byproducts such as sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides, have increased the acidity of the atmosphere, and this may be increasing the bioavailability of the iron. In addition, humans burn things like coal, which has crustal material in it, and could be directly releasing soluble iron into the atmosphere. And there are several observational studies that have suggested this. What we did was we took those observational studies as well as the very limited soluble iron data for the current climate, and I have to emphasize again the very, very limited soluble iron data, and we took a look at what the implications were for soluble iron deposition to the oceans in a model. And what I'm showing you here is the increase in soluble iron in the current climate relative to the pre-industrial climate that we estimate from changes in atmospheric processing and changes in direct combustion soluble iron emissions. And you can see that over much of the oceans, you get a 2 to 5 fold increase in soluble iron. The places that in particular that we want to emphasize is the Southern Ocean, which is a green, so it's maybe 10, it's between 1 and 1.2, and the Eastern Equatorial Pacific there. So there's increases in regions that are these high nutrient, low chlorophyll regions that are especially sensitive to soluble iron inputs. In addition, another place is the North Pacific, which is getting a big boost of soluble iron inputs from the growth in industry in Asia. The North Pacific is thought sometimes to be iron limited as well. So if we take these estimates of increase in soluble iron and when we put them into an ocean biogeochemistry model, and here I'm using the results from a model developed by Scott Doney, Keith Lindsay, and Keith Moore, and we work together to take those estimates of the increase in soluble iron to estimate the impact then on the nitrogen cycle as well as the uptake of CO2. And you can see, I can't point, but the middle top panel, it shows an increase in nitrogen fixation. So those lines, when those lines start diverging, that's the point where we add in extra soluble iron in a transient simulations for 130 years from pre-industrial to current. So just to show the system was in equilibrium, and then it is perturbed by this additional human added soluble iron. And you can see significant perturbations to the nitrogen cycle and an increase in productivity because of the iron and the increase in the soluble iron. So we had a doubling of soluble iron causing a large perturbation, but not anything like a doubling of the nitrogen cycle or a doubling of the productivity. And the CO2 changes are about 2 ppm. And again, for relative importance, we've seen an increase in CO2 of 100 ppm. So this 2 ppm is 2% of the anthropogenic signal that we're seeing right now. It goes in the opposite direction. I'm sorry, how am I doing for time? So I'm going to talk really briefly about work that we have in PREP right now. In the new generation of Earth system models, we predict not only the physical climate and the climate changes, but we also predict the carbon cycle. And that's what's going to be in the next IPCC. And, of course, this is important to do because half of the anthropogenic carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere is taken up by the land or the oceans. And each one of these climate system models pulls down that carbon in a slightly different way. And we need to understand what our uncertainties are in terms of how much we can emit and still stay under, for example, a 2-degree increase in temperature. Let's see. I'm going to do this pretty briefly. I just want to show, first of all, the spread in the simulations of carbon dioxide from the last IPCC. So this is the first generation of coupled carbon climate models. And you can see, given with basically the same emissions from humans, you get about, at 2100, you have about 300 ppm difference in the final CO2. Okay? That's a lot of uncertainties just derived from which model you use. For the model that we use at the, and I work with the Community Climate System Model, one of the foremost U.S. models, what we included was nitrogen co-limitation on land. And we get a rather high simulation, and you can see a whole set of simulations. They're all ending at, say, about 600 ppm. And one of the reasons we get a lot of carbon dioxide staying in the atmosphere is because of the co-limitation of nitrogen on the terrestrial biosphere. So that reduces the amount of carbon fertilization that the model allows. I don't want to talk about that too much. That was a paper that was published last year. But in this same model, we include dust. And indeed, we include a doubling of dust and a halving of dust. And all of those simulations are actually on that same plot. And you can see that if we if you look at it from the distance you're looking at, it doesn't matter. The impact of aerosols is not important compared to which model you're using. If we look in a little bit more detail and take out the mean response and instead look at what happens with the a doubling of dust or a halving of dust in this fully coupled carbon cycle, I don't have time to explain this completely, but basically what happens is the ocean pulls down about 10 more ppm, but the land then sees less carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and pulls down less. So there's some coupling between the land and the ocean, and they have interesting feedbacks that reduce the signal from just, say, doubling dust or halving dust. So to conclude, dust is both a driver and an archiver of climate, and it's very sensitive. And the idea that humans would not perturb dust seems to me not consistent with the available paleo data or what data we have in the current climate. However, we don't know what humans are doing in the current climate still because of a lack of, I would argue, lack of data. Desert dust is usually important at maybe 0 to 30%. What I want to argue here, and this is consistent with what Karen said, dust is not the dominant forcer of climate. It's an important feedback at the global level, but it's not a dominant forcer. Regionally, desert dust can be very important, as we saw in the Sahel drought. The sea surface temperatures were driving most of the Sahel drought, but the existence of the dust and the pushing of the precipitation away from North Africa significantly impacted the Sahel drought. If we want to understand past and future regional changes, as we're trying to move towards in the future and really understanding decadal predictability of climate and biogeochemistry, we need to include dust in those simulations. Thank you.
I guess so. We need Oliver and his. Is he up next?
Go ahead. We have plenty of time.
Thank you, Natalie. Our next speaker is Joe Prospero, who you've also all heard his name a few times. And Joe is going to talk us about intercontinental dust transport and linkages to climate and the environment.
This work? Yeah, here it goes. Can't see real well. Okay. Good afternoon, lovers of dust. I'm going to put this present day's talk in the context of a talk I gave at a AAAS meeting in 2004. At that meeting, it reached some conclusions. It says dust mobilization over Africa and transport over the Atlantic was linked to rainfall deficits in North Africa, and Natalie touched on that, and it was in a fairly clear way. Major spikes in dust transport seem to follow strong El Nino events, and so the question for the present presentation is, with 10 more years of data and all the variability that we're seeing, how do these conclusions stand up? And there's the end of the talk right there, and the answer is not well. I'm focusing on the work that we've done in Barbados because it is the longest continuous dust record anywhere. So you can see Barbados 5,000 kilometers from the coast of Africa, and another 1,000 kilometers or so from the actual sources in North Africa. Give you a sense of where we are. That's the island of Barbados, and we are located at a site on the very much the eastern coast of the island, one of the beautiful, beautiful site there, and hopefully we will prevent condominiums from being built there, and that is our station. We sample from the top of that tower. This is what a couple of years of the dust record looks like. These are daily samples. The x-axis here is micrograms of mineral dust per cubic meter of air, and we have time down here. And what you see, can't point very well with this thing, but what you see are a clear seasonality with low concentrations in the winter, and things pick up in the spring sporadically, and then you get into the summer, and you see essentially constant dust transport. You go into the fall, the winter again low, next spring sporadic dust, and then the next summer. And this fits in nicely with the satellite image, which Natalie has introduced you to. These are NOAA AVHRR. This is the December, January, February aerosol optical depth, and you see this plume going over to South America, and Barbados is right up there on the northern edge of that plume, and that corresponds to these periods when we have relatively low dust and spikes, occasional small spikes, and then we get into the summer, and then we're located right in, Barbados is located right in the heart of this plume coming across the Atlantic. This is what it looks like from an aircraft at about 8 kilometers over Barbados, this dense layer of dust, which typically extends from the surface up to 3, perhaps 4 kilometers. And this is a view from our site looking north, and that point of land is about 10 kilometers away. So these are very high dust concentrations. I'll skip over this one. But I'm talking about Barbados, but we make measurements elsewhere in the North Atlantic, including Miami and Bermuda, as Dan has referred to. And to substantiate Dan's story about the geological significance, this is the hood and the roof of my car on the 19th of July of 2009, when we had fairly high dust concentrations and just a very brief squirt of rain. And these are just little dots of African dust. And I took Wattman 41 filters and wrapped them over a moist sponge and wiped the top of my car. And what we've seen is a dust deposition event of about 20 micrograms per square meter in that one event. That's about 10% of the annual deposition that we measure in Florida. This is what the dust record looks like as I presented it in the 2004 meeting. What you see on the ordinate here is the dust concentration, micrograms per cubic meter of air. And here you see the monthly mean values. And this pointer doesn't work very well, despite all of our efforts to get it. But you see this annual cycle with a peak in the summer months and a minimum in the winter. And you see when we began in the late 60s, relatively low concentrations. As we get into the late 60s, early 70s, drought set in Africa. We have a very large increase in dust. It ameliorated a bit. And then the early 80s, tremendous drought in Africa, a lot of deaths, hundreds of thousands of people died. And again, it goes through the cycle. And everyone focuses on these big peaks, but I point out that there's something going on also in the winter months and the other seasons, and I'm going to address that in the talk. These arrows point at the top, point to the major El Niños as identified by the NOAA El Niño site. And those seem to suggest that these major El Niños sort of preceded these big dust peaks. So that's one of the conclusions from the previous talk. And in the context of the previous talk, we showed the drought record from Africa. This is Peter Lamb's record, 20 or so stations in the Sahel and Sudan region. And this begins in 1940. And you see in 1940, you have relatively, this is measured, the rainfall anomalies are measured in standard deviations from the mean. So it's normalized standard deviations. And so in the early 50s, it was a particularly wet period. You had 1.5 standard deviations above the long-term mean. And then when you get into the late 60s, you go into drought. So this is the early 70s drought, and this is the early 80s drought. And now you see the rest of the record. The box shows you what data we had in our last meeting, in the 2004 meeting, where I showed you the next slide, which shows that if you take the dust concentration measured in Barbados and plot it against the previous year rainfall anomaly measured in standard deviations on the x-axis, you get a very nice correlation. In fact, over the years, we've had three major papers on this, the first in Science in the mid-70s, one in Nature in the mid-80s, and now this third paper in 2003 in Science on the data up to 98. And every time we've added more data, that correlation has gotten better. No more. Anyhow, this is the new data. This is the same record you saw before. The box shows our new data. And dust levels continue to be high, and there's some interesting stuff going on there, but let's look at the annual means. And this is the annual mean. On the left is the annual mean for this entire period. And over here is the three-year. On the right is the three-year running mean for that data. And the red lines are simply put there by me to guide your eye. They don't have any statistical significance. But what I'm suggesting is that what we've seen from the beginning of our record in the late 1960s through the early middle 1980s, a steady increase in dust with these huge spikes on top of it in the early 70s and 80s, but now we see a relatively stable concentration. That is the year-to-year variation around what seems to be a flat concentration. If you look at the seasonal now variability, we see a different picture. Okay, so these now is the same data. These are three-year moving averages broken in season, December, January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November. And you'll notice the arrows point out to you that the scales are all different. And the June, July, August is the dominant one. That's the dominant transport season. And here you see very clearly the increase from the late 60s to the peak in the drought of the early 70s, falling off then the early 80s, and then essentially flat. But if you look at the other distributions, you see a dramatic difference. First of all, in a lot of these, December, January, February, March, April, May, they doesn't see the early 70s drought. And what you see is that, in particularly in March, April, May, that you go from very low levels to extremely high levels, an order of magnitude greater. In the 60s, this was a couple micrograms per cubic meter of air, and now you're up to 15, 20 micrograms per cubic meter of air. So we tend to focus on the overall picture, and yet we're seeing that with this large change in climate, we've gotten a very substantial difference in the whole transport scenario for these dust events. So now this is the all four seasons of the NOAA AVHRR, but I wanted to just now lay on top of this, on the left, the data which I just showed you for December, January, February. And here you see, as I said, there's essentially no response to the early 70s drought and a huge response to the 80s drought. And this is the March, April, May data here. And these plumes then that you see in the NOAA AVHRR image suggest that what we're seeing is dust coming from this region in the Sahel and Sudan region. And if you look now, these are the same NOAA AVHRR aerosol optical depth products. This is a depiction of the dust activity in North Africa. This is a paper we did in 2003 where we used the TOMS, the TOMS satellite data for aerosol, absorbing aerosol, and by looking at the frequency and intensity of the product, the aerosol product, we identify the areas which are the most significant sources, and they have a number of characteristics in common. They're topographic lows, they were flooded in the Pleistocene or the Holocene, and even today there's evidence of substantial fluvial activity, and there are large deposits of alluvial soils which can serve as the source of dust. The largest dust source in Africa is the Bodeli Depression. It is this large dark gray blob here. This is a MODIS satellite image of Chad. This is Lake Chad here, where this arrow is, and this is the Bodeli Depression. In the winter and spring, you can go to the MODIS website, and you can see this depression putting out huge quantities of dust almost continuously. And this is it's an interesting source. Washington and Todd, a group of Oxford, have had a field experiment there. It's a freshwater deposit. The whitish color of the plume is due to freshwater diatoms, mixed with a lot of dust as well. So this now, on the left, is the annual mean dust concentration, and it's plotted over the Lamb Sahel Sudan rainfall index, but now I've inverted the index so that at the top we have dry and at the bottom we have wet. And here you see the huge drought impacts, and then you see the character changing very dramatically in the late 80s and into the, and up to the present time, and now actually it's swinging occasionally into the wet wet phases. And again, I show you the satellite, the TOMS product, and this is the lower right is a depiction of the Sahel region, which is the region defined by the 200 to the 600 millimeter isohyets, and the Sudan region to the south, which is largely savanna. So the large dust sources that we see that are so active are largely in that Sahel Sudan region. So to go back to 2004, this is the scatter plot of the dust concentration in Barbados against the Sahel Sudan rainfall index, the previous year rain index that gives us such a nice scatter plot with R squared of 0.59. And now we add in 10 more years of data and things start to go bad for the first time in our many years of doing this. And we see that R squared has dropped off considerably. There's a much wider scatter. And you can see that more clearly here on the left where I plot in blue the data to 98, the data which I showed at the last AAAS meeting, and red is the data for the last 10 years. And on the upper right, I plot the data for the last 20 years against the rainfall, the Sahel rainfall index, and that is shown, that data is shown in the box here. There's no correlation. So it's counterintuitive. I mean, we like to think that dryness is associated with dust production, but I've repeatedly stressed over the years that by plotting the dust transport against precipitation, we were not necessarily implying it was the precipitation itself that was the critical issue, but the associated meteorological conditions that were that went with the variability in rainfall. So that there are three major elements in doing long-range transport: sources, it's the transport, and the deposition. So we don't know which is controlling. But there's a lot of things that have been going on over the Atlantic. And just to show you, this is a paper by Becky and Knudsen, who are interested in tropical cyclones. And they plot a number of variables over the North Atlantic. The top line is the global mean temperature. Then there are a series of sea surface temperature estimates. And then it gets down into the red. You have the number of tropical storms, et cetera. You can read that. The red bar I have going up the record shows where our aerosol record begins in Barbados. And you can see that over the period, a long period of time, that these various factors here were relatively stable. For example, it was a period of time when there were relatively few tropical storms and hurricanes. But now, in the 90s, all of a sudden that pattern, the frequency of hurricanes, tropical storms increased, and other things changed, including sea surface temperatures. And in concert with that, something has changed with the way dust is generated and transported. As Natalie has indicated, the Atlantic sea surface temperature is a very critical issue on North African climate and in the monsoon system. So there seems to be some aspect, some factor, which has brought about a shift in the way the dust is generated and transported. And I point out that there was a lot of talk in 2005, after Katrina and the other hurricanes, that one of the reasons why they had such a bad hurricane year was that the dust concentrations were lower that year. That statement was based on satellite measurements. And consequently, you had higher sea surface temperatures, which supposedly resulted in greater hurricane activity. On our data, the arrow shows 2005, there was nothing unusual about that year. So that story, at least based on what we have, doesn't sound very feasible anymore. A lot of other things have been going on, and one of them relates to the whole question of human impacts. And this is a figure I just picked out of literature showing the change in, on the left, is the change in total population in West Africa, and there are the top lines, the total population, and then it distinguishes between urban population and the rural population, and it shows that the urban population is increasing much more rapidly than the rural. But I have two lines here as well. The first line, red line on the left, is the beginning of our measurements, and the line on the right is where we are today. So the population in that region, at the time this paper was written in 2001, these are hypothesized, modeled projections of population. On the right is the number of cities with population greater than 50,000 inhabitants. The top panel is 1960, the middle is 1990, and the bottom is projected for 2020. So what we're seeing then is an area which is an important dust source for a variety of reasons in the geological wet climate sense, but there's this added factor of the land use and increasing population in this region. And finally, I want to wrap up with two points. One of them is the model projections for future climate, and in particular, the projected changes in precipitation. This is from the IPCC report, and these are the, on the left is the December, January, February multi-model projection. On the right is June, July, August, and the brown areas are the modeled reductions in precipitation, and the bluish areas are modeled increases. The white areas are undecided. The criteria for drawing this figure is that if 66% of the models, two-thirds of the models, didn't agree, then they did not make any prediction. At the other extreme, if over 90% of the models agreed, then they stippled the areas in. So you see there's no agreement on these important areas that we see as dust sources today in December, January, February, and most notably in the summer months, which are now the months of the greatest dust transport. So we don't know, on the basis of the IPCC models, what to expect from there. And we also see there's considerable uncertainty, particularly in the winter months, where we have seen this very large increase in dust relative to the changes in the other regions. So we see there's a lot of uncertainty in the productions, or certainly very little unanimity, except right along the coast, as to what is going to happen there, although it is predicted to go drier. So we could see a major shift in dust source activity, even though those areas are quite dusty now, but we could see increased activity from those regions in the future. And finally, the one issue on human impacts. What I show here is 1 year of mineral dust data from Barbados. On the ordinate is the dust concentration of micrograms per cubic meter of air. These are daily samples, and there's 1 year of data here. 1997, which was a moderately dusty year. I have two lines on there, but they relate to the EPA PM standards and the 24-hour standards. The EPA PM 2.5 standard is 35 micrograms per cubic meter of air, and the PM10 standard is 150 micrograms per cubic meter of air, and about half of the dust mass in Barbados is PM2.5, and over 90% is PM10. So if you, the red line, which I draw here, is at 70 micrograms per cubic meter of air, so any dust concentrations above that red line would exceed the PM2.5 standard from the EPA. So there are about, on this particular data series, there are about 20 days of the year in Barbados when the PM2.5 standard is exceeded, and there are several days when the PM10 standard is exceeded. So there is a long-range impact on health. Well, I shouldn't say there's a potential long-range impact on health, because we really don't know to what extent the EPA PM2.5 or PM10 standards, which were established for basis of statistics in built-up continental areas, urban areas, we don't know whether that transfers to the pure mineral dust, and we don't simply don't understand the toxicology of that sort of thing, and that's that perhaps the next speaker will address that issue. But so when we think of climate change, then here we see a site 7,000 kilometers from the sources, and having an impact, potential impact on air quality and health over a large region. And this, of course, this dust also is brought to the Southeast U.S. and the Gulf Coast U.S. as well. So I conclude, there is now no clear relationship between dust transport and rainfall. So that nice picture we had, which stood up so well over 30-some years, no longer holds, and we don't understand why. The seasonal pattern of dust transport, as I pointed out, has changed over time. So now that we see a very strong difference in seasonal transport with the summer transport, although it's still dominant, increased following the drought, but there was a much stronger change in the other seasons. And it's not at all clear why those changes occurred, whether it's the activity of the sources or the transport patterns or whatever. And because of the uncertainties in rainfall projections, climate in general, and population trends in that region of West Africa, it's population trends and infer land use, it's going to be difficult really to make any projections of what's going to happen from the standpoint of dust mobilization and transport. And finally, the last point, which I made, had to do with the possible impact on human health. Thank you. Well, Miami, you have so many other factors to deconvolute with that data. The best place would be to do it in Barbados. We've done that, in effect, for asthma. We can't see any immediate day-to-day impact of dust on asthma admission rates or attendance rates in Barbados. There could well be a chronic effect, and there's a group at Johns Hopkins that is on Barbados now. They're starting to do personal monitoring, and they're also taking measurements at our site to try to relate exposure, the aerosol exposure. Barbados is ideal for it because, first of all, there is very little in the way of pollution sources. There's very little industrial activity. It's a well-ventilated island. And well, there anyone interested in going to Chad or? there are a lot of problems, and Natalie can tell you some of the problems of using satellite data to get. There are very few good long-term records of aerosol concentrations over land. ABHRR, which is our longest data record, goes back to the late 70s, is great, but it's useless over land. And you only recently have some satellite products that give you response over land, but there's no long-term record that you could compare with. I mean, this is our record is the only long-term record that goes back, that predates the drought itself, other than using things such as visibility or trying to infer from visibility observations at logical stations in North Africa. And a number of people have done that, including Natalie. But it is a problem. And I've long suggested that really what we should do is identify a number of places we recognize as hotspots and to begin a systematic periodic studies of these spots over time to see how that varies in climate. I mean, they've done that. USGS, I know, has done that with some spots in the southwest. But no one, to my knowledge, has done that in these sorts of areas. Africa. I think Washington, the group at Oxford, is planning to do some of that sort of stuff with cameras and remote sensing on sites. But it's a huge logistics and here's Natalie now. Natalie is the Washington group making any plans to do any systematic monitoring of the Bodelli or any of the other sources there? I heard they were thinking about doing that. And Yeah. That's a major problem. You heard the joke about the drunk who loses is looking for his watch under the lamplight, even though he lost it in the dark and obviously couldn't find it in the dark, so he looked under the lamp. Anyhow, yes, Dan?
Just a comment following up on this. This is an interesting question because although the MODIS imagery, which gives out are very recent, we don't have records of the older ones, but in some composition of the dust doesn't look like it has, for example,
yeah, but the diatomite stuff is going to be pretty big for the most part. If you look at individual images of the filters and the like, you will see some little tiny fragments sometime of diatoms, freshwater diatoms. One of the characteristics of composition of this stuff is so uniform because these are in effect. Africa, North Africa, is a huge internal mixing basin, which, you know, you start out with mountains and then big boulders and rocks, and the stuff keeps getting weathered and transported fluvially and eventually by winds from one basin to another. And finally, you know, the very finest component, which has had the roughest history, gets transported to the Atlantic. And so it's very difficult to, in looking at a lot of, we had a paper recently comparing dust events and looking at time series, and it's very difficult to pull out. Although I have to say that we focus primarily on the summer transport period, but we do have to go. We have to go back again and look at the issue of the longer time series and looking more carefully at the winter and spring and fall dust composition to see whether we can see any changes over time. We have 45 years of samples. Anyone who would care to play with them, give me a call, send me an email.
Albert Chadwick from... He's got a Mac, so we're going to applause him.
There's always one in the crowd.
But we're going to sort of switch gears slightly and move down to how the dust depends on ecosystems.
Okay, let's see. This is. Oh, great. Thanks. Okay, let me get coordinated here. So, this discussion just before I came up was actually very relevant to the things that I want to talk about in terms of terrestrial ecosystems and the impact of dust on terrestrial ecosystems. Joe was talking about the geology in North Africa and how there's this sort of long-term decomposition of rock down into finer and finer particles, and finally the finest particles end up being entrained in the atmosphere and carried some distance away. Not all of that material ends up in either the ocean or in desert areas. This image just shows the major source areas for dust, and you're quite familiar with these by now. But they're primarily the arid and semi-arid regions of the world. And so the emission of dust from those regions has a local impact on plants as well as then, and that local impact tends to be quite physical in nature. And then it has a long distance impact on other ecosystems around the world, and particularly ecosystems that may in fact have poor soils because of high leaching in wet areas. And dust, of course, is preferentially washed out of the atmosphere by rainfall. And so with increasing rainfall, we can have increasing dust washout. If we just take a look quickly at emission by region in the world, North Africa, what we've just been talking about, is really the 800-pound gorilla. But if you sum up some of the Asian sources, they're fairly substantial as well. Couple that with the Arabian Peninsula, and you have most of it lessens in South America and North America. Now, in the areas where we get the dust emission, now, some of these areas, of course, are just bare stream channels, alluvial fans, and this sort of thing in desert regions, playa surfaces. Others are areas that are just sparsely vegetated. And essentially, if you begin to think about the role of vegetation in limiting the emission of dust, essentially what we have is the fact that the this pointer doesn't work. That the more dense the vegetation is, the less likely it is that you're going to get dust, or you're going to get wind moving material in saltation processes that then break apart individual grains, making finer material that eventually gets lifted into the atmosphere. As soon as you begin to have breaks in the vegetation, so that you begin to get gaps, then you have a situation where the wind can reach the surface. It can then create more and more saltation processes, more and more fine material moving across the landscape and essentially destroying more vegetation. And so you end up with a feedback process that keeps opening gaps further and further, and you get more and more emission of material. If you look then, on the y-axis here is a plot of the horizontal flux of dust in grams per centimeter per day. And then across the x-axis is the ratio of the average gap size to the canopy height. So essentially what we're looking at here is a plot that provides us with a sense of how close you can get wind to the surface. And the solid line that you see in the graph is basically showing the horizontal emission that you would expect under relatively natural conditions. The shaded line, the slightly faded outline, actually shows essentially what you would expect under a suite of specific desertification processes where you begin to get gaps forming in the landscape. And what that shows is basically that starting with dry woodland, moving through grassland, and then towards shrubland, We get the sort of maximum perturbation associated with local erosion processes. And this has very strong physical effects, and removal of nutrients from this local environment, entraining those nutrients into the atmosphere. And both Karen and Natalie talked about the fact that these nutrients that are entrained in the dust flow then end up being carried and deposited in oceans, where they stimulate plankton production. One of the interesting questions is, to what extent does this efflux of dust from desert regions then lead to a fertilization of terrestrial ecosystems? And that's a tougher question to answer, because of the fact that in many cases what we're doing is we're putting nutrients and soil material back onto soil again. And so it's very hard to measure the distinctly the same material or very similar material as it's coming in and really understand the impact of that material. So it takes a little ingenuity to try to come up with some numbers on that. There are places where measurements have been made around the world of dust deposition, and this plot shows some of those. And beyond just the magnitude of the dust deposition, it's also showing, as I'll show in the next slide, these sites, there have been measurements of the elemental composition of the dust as well. And you'll note down at the bottom here that basically there are three categories that range from up to 1 gram per meter squared per year, 1 to 50, and then 50 to 500 grams per meter squared per year. And over some of the continental areas is where we typically find the highest levels. But you can see across the Atlantic in the area that Joe was talking about, that all through there are pretty high levels of dust deposition. Out in the Pacific, the levels are quite low. If we look at the elemental composition of these dust in some of these dust areas, and average over the over all the sites, this plot shows an enrichment factor relative to the upper continental crust. So one way one can index these kind of these kind of measurements is to ask, what would you expect in the upper continental crust or in eroding rock from the continent on an average basis? And then if we look at these plots, we can see a few interesting trends. So most of those data plot fairly close to the average continental crust, but we have an enrichment in calcium, in iron, and titanium, and phosphorus relative to the upper continental crust. And what that's basically telling us is that we're eroding soil material, and that that soil material then is carrying those elements that are concentrated, like titanium and iron, and calcium from calcium carbonate precipitates in desert soils. To the right, you can see that copper, nickel, cobalt, chromium, and lead are all highly enriched relative to the background. And, of course, those are coming from industrial sources, human impact sources. If we take a look then, and we look at the phosphorus composition of dust input, we're particularly focused on phosphorus for terrestrial ecosystems because after nitrogen, phosphorus tends to be one of the most limiting elements in terrestrial ecosystems. If we look at phosphorus here, we could see that the data vary from Hawaii out here at just under 0.01 kilograms per hectare per year of input, ranging up to, around kilogram per hectare for locally near the Sahel, and values down here not too dissimilar from Hawaii down in the Amazon region, and here in Puerto Rico, the values are somewhere on the order of 0.2 to point around 0.2 kilograms per hectare per year. So, so one of the questions we want to ask is, given these kind of inputs of phosphorus, does it matter? Does it matter to a terrestrial ecosystem if they're receiving this kind of fertilization from dust? To do that, interestingly, we've actually gone to Hawaii, which has the lowest flux of phosphorus, and we've been able to probably most effectively answer that question in Hawaii, to a great extent because Hawaii provides us with kind of a model system that is far less complex than the continental environment. And this continental system, this Hawaii, this model system basically is composed of volcanic rock. And the volcanic rock has certain compositional features that we can separate from the dust coming in. Before I get into that, let me just give you an idea of what we've done here. Basically, we use Hawaii as a natural lab where we can sample different age soils on different lava flows all the way across the islands. We can also vary climate as well. In this study that I'm going to be telling you about, we sampled this different age soils ranging from 300 years to over 4 million years at the same present-day rainfall of about 2,500 millimeters of rain. We've been able to then, using fertilizer experiments, the same kind of experiments you'd use in an agricultural field, in the rainforests in Hawaii, my colleague Peter Vitusik has been able to establish something about the forest response to fertilizer additions. And essentially what we see here is that that for a 300-year-old forest, when you add nitrogen, you get a response over the control. When you add phosphorus, you don't get a response. When you add phosphorus and nitrogen together, you get a response. If you come down to this oldest soil on Kauai landscape, if you add nitrogen, you get no increase in productivity, but if you add phosphorus or you add nitrogen and phosphorus together, you get a strong response. So basically what that tells us is that the forests in Kauai are phosphorus deficient and will respond to phosphorus increased inputs. So one of the questions is, do we get enough phosphorus input from dust from Asia that it matters? In order to answer that question, we have to be able to separate out the dust component in that ecosystem from the underlying basalt. We can do that in three different ways using three different tracers. Basically, we can use neodymium isotopes, which the epsilon neodymium value for the Hawaiian basalt is plus 7. It's minus 10 for the Asian dust. Same way, the strontium 87-86 ratio is about 0.703 for basalt. It's about 0.72 for Asian dust. Also, we find that the underlying lavas in Hawaii have no quartz and no mica in them, and so the dust coming in from Asia has maybe 30 to 50% of its composition in quartz plus mica. So we can use these three different tracers as ways to ask the question of how much dust is input to the system. We've made calculations using the most conservative of the of those tools, which are the neodymium, epsilon neodymium, and the quartz based techniques. And basically what we find is that not a lot of correspondence between the two techniques for the 20,000-year-old soil. But for the 150,000-year-old soil, we have very good agreement. We have agreement, fairly good agreement out in the older soils, but the dust input values are considerably lower because we suspect we're getting a certain amount of erosion, so we don't have a full accounting. So we actually have selected this 150,000-year-old flow as being the one that probably best represents the maximum input of dust over long time periods, and gives us a rate of about 125 milligrams per centimeter squared per year, per 1,000 years. Okay, what does this mean in terms of then the forest response? Well, basically what we could do is we could take the input of phosphorus from two different sources. The dust input that we just calculated is shown by this line here. The second input is basically the weathering release of phosphorus to the ecosystem over at different time points across the islands. And what we could see as we go out to older and older flows, the weathering release declines. And by the time we get to somewhat over a million years, the weathering release is less than that's coming in on an annual basis from the phosphorus. And we can basically calculate in the contribution from atmospheric input or dust, and it ranges from relatively low at 150,000 years to about 40% by over a million years, and to virtually 100% by the time we get out to the oldest stable soils on Kauai. So what we can infer from this is that the dust coming in is actually providing enough phosphorus to fertilize the rainforest and maintain a productivity that we would not be getting under other circumstances. We can only do this because we have this combination of fertilizer experiments in the forest, which took an incredible amount of work, and so a lot of infrastructure input. Also, the fortuitous fact that we can use isotopes to actually sort out the long-term input of nutrients to the ecosystem. But that doesn't mean that other places probably don't have this kind of impact. And Julie Petrich, who's at Oregon State University, took a crack at actually making calculations for Puerto Rico, for the Luquillo Mountains in Puerto Rico, where there's quite a lot of information. And she had done her PhD work studying the isotopic evolution of the weathering profiles there. So she took a crack at making similar calculations. But rather than the dust deposition being on the order of phosphorus being on the order of 0.009, it's more like 0.23. So there's a much greater dust input from Africa than there is from Asia to Hawaii. And that input is very much on the same order as the weathering input from the saprolite input, as it's shown there on the plot. and is balanced then by leaching output and erosion output processes. So to a first order, certainly the dust deposition of phosphorus in the system doesn't look too bad. And if one takes a look at that input relative to what we see in Hawaii, you can see that it's much greater as Joe and others have been tracking the dust coming from Africa into the Caribbean. The dust deposition input of phosphorus is similar in magnitude to the other inputs, as I said, and it constitutes about 15% of the annual plant uptake in Luquillo Forest. So, another way to look at this is that although the soil residence time in the landscape is about 15,000 years, the soil phosphorus turnover time is only about 2,000 years. So that suggests that phosphorus is cycling quite rapidly through the system, and any dust that you put in is going to maintain that cycle. Petrich went further to take a look at this and to think about the nature of erosion in Puerto Rico, and much of the erosion occurs by landsliding. And one of the things that people have found about landsliding is that after slides occur, there is a depletion of phosphorus as you lose the surface soil material. And it takes a number of years for that phosphorus to be replenished by a combination of weathering of the rock and accumulation of the dust. But considering that the dust impact input of phosphorus was actually greater than the input from weathering of saprolite, we might expect that that input of dust is very important in terms of regenerating the phosphorus needed to maintain the forest ecosystem. We don't have the fertilizer studies to nail this particular story in the same way that exists in Hawaii, but the story I think is very compelling that that the forests in the Caribbean are in fact being maintained by the phosphorus coming in from the dust from North Africa. I want to turn, the last point I want to turn to is the question of human land use impacts, because what we've been doing is dominantly looking at the long-term record and how that may be impacting ecosystem function. But we know that humans are the 800-pound gorilla in the way in which land use impacts environment. And this is a very nice data from a very nice paper that data were shown earlier. I think Karen showed it. And this is from a paper by Jason Neff and others in Nature Geology, in which they basically cored lakes in the Rocky Mountains and were able to show a dramatic increase in the amount of dust accumulating, amount of mass of material accumulating in the lakes starting about 200 years ago, 150 to 200 years ago, which essentially then mimics the time in which grazing intensity really ramped up in the Intermountain West. And along with that, they basically showed that the phosphorus input to these systems increased as well, as did the calcium, and it increased by on the order of a factor of 3 to 5 for the phosphorus. So there's quite a dramatic increase in the input of nutrient to both aquatic ecosystems, where we have the record in this case, but also to the terrestrial ecosystems around them, to the extent that they may or may not be responsive to that input. One final thing I want to point out here is that this particular Dust Devil was filmed in Mato Grosso in Brazil, in areas where very, very large tracts of land have been cleared and are being planted to soybean. And you will have noticed the last little bit of that, there was dust blowing into the nearby rainforest. So the forests have been cleared. They're now being planted to soybean. And whereas we were talking about dust inputs to ecosystems of maybe 0.23 kilograms per hectare per year from natural background sources, these fields are receiving between 40 and 50 kilograms per hectare per year in terms of phosphorus. Then, just because agriculture is not entirely efficient, you get the land being left cleared for periods of time, wind stirring that up and carrying the surface soil away. And the surface soil is the richest part, in part because of the fact that that the farmers are maintaining the fertility of these systems by adding both phosphorus and calcium, both of which have been shown to be in very short supply in the Brazilian rainforests. So so this opening up of the of the southern part of the Amazon basin to agriculture has really, really profound effects on the nature of the redistribution of nutrients into the into the nearby forests. And when I say nearby, obviously the image I just showed you was basically the edge. But there's no reason to expect that we're not getting fairly substantial dust mobilization for hundreds of kilometers moving into those kind of environments. So in conclusion, I just want to say that it's hard to really get an understanding of the importance of the background signature of dust input to terrestrial ecosystems, but we can do it in certain places, and those places then provide us with the model to interpret how the rest of the system may be working. And second of all, I think that if we really want to think about the terrestrial ecosystem impact of dust, we need to be thinking and quantifying the human impact component of this system. There we see these kinds of dust events in many parts of the U.S. and during agricultural periods. We don't think of them as being as important as we might think of in the Amazon, only because the soils may be richer that are that dust is impacting. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you.
further questions, we're going to have a discussion session afterwards, and I'll be available to ask more questions later on. Okay, our last speaker of the session, and like I said, we're going to have a couple discussants talk after the speakers are finished, and then there'll be a question and answer period after that, is Jeff Plumley from the U.S. Geological Survey. And we're going one step further. We're going to talk about dust and us now for a while. And he's going to be talking about airborne matter geotoxicology. There's a good word for you. And public health policy and environmental security.
Okay, well, we'll see if it came up. All right. Well, thanks very much for those of you that are sticking around to the dusty end of this session. We're going to change quite a bit from previous discussions and start talking about something that I've been working on for the last 10 years or so with a bunch of really sharp people both inside and outside the earth sciences, and that is trying to bridge the gap between earth sciences and public health. So one of the very nice ways that one of the very nice topics that allows us to do this is looking at the influence of dusts and other atmospheric particulate matter and their roles in health, and both looking at what the characteristics are of the particulate matter that might lead to toxicity, but also looking at the sources and things like that and seeing what we can do from as an earth scientist perspective to help anticipate and understand different sources of particulate matter. I'll also touch a little bit on implications as we go for public policy and environmental security as well. A large number of colleagues that I want to acknowledge, both within inside and outside the USGS. The outside colleagues are a lot of folks from the public health community, toxicologists, pulmonary medicine specialists, others. However, I must stress that if I sort of venture into erroneous ground from a public health perspective, this is an earth science perspective, please don't hold those folks to blame. I'll take the full blame myself. So this is one of those wall clouds that I think others have shown pictures of before. That's probably several, at least a kilometer, if not 1,500 meters high, advancing across the desert. One thing I like to do when I give talks like this is always show some headlines from fairly recent media just to show that this is a topic of keen interest in the media and to the general public. You saw this last fall in Australia. There were public health alerts due to the high particulate matter loading. This is what turned Sydney's sky red, like Mars. This just came out the other day. I just found this as I was getting ready for this talk. Salinas Valley house dust carries pesticides, implying that soils from the agricultural fields that had been dosed with pesticides were now getting mobilized and carried into the house. Now, that obviously is a question of whether that is a health issue or not that I think needs will be the focus of further study. This is from last fall, the station fire, just to show you that these aren't local issues. They can be broader, and I'll talk more about this later in the talk. And this just came out. This has been sort of perking along that I'm not sure a lot of people know about, issues on exposure to particulate matter of our troops in the Middle East. This particular case is looking at the health effects of exposure to smoke from burn pits where they're combusting trash at various bases, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. So what is airborne? I'm looking more broadly than just dusts. What's airborne particulate matter? Basically other dust, solid, liquid particles, and actually I would say have to say living particles as well, microbes, that are transported in the atmosphere, and they're generated. And we tend to sort of try to bin these things or look at a continuum between things that come from largely the natural environment or geogenic and then the anthropogenic environment produced by humans. And then there's this whole sort of gray area in between that I call geoanthropogenic because there are characteristics of the dust or particulate matter that owe their origin to both the earth and to human activities. And this is something that is, of course, from seeing those headlines and others, that is of very high interest to the public and the public health people. And in the scales I'm going to be talking about range anywhere from very local to intercontinental. So some examples of particulate matter, and this is the geogenic versus anthropogenic continuum. with geoanthropogenic in the middle. Clearly, volcanic ash and volcanic fog or VOG, volcanic gases, are very clearly geogenic. Then things like particulate combustion, PM from combustion of fossil fuels, urban particulate matter, commercial asbestos are more anthropogenic. And then you have these things like wildfire ash and smoke, desert dusts, geologic or naturally occurring asbestos, naturally occurring pathogens in dust that have some influence from both humans and the earth. And so, for example, the wildfire ash and smoke, it's a natural process, but the fires are combusting forests that have been enhanced in their combustibility by fire suppression activities or started by humans or things like that. So, and this is a case where I'm giving my earth science perspective. That's the disclaimer on when I talk about health effects, and this is from talking with my colleagues and doing a lot of reading. But there are a lot of different effects of potential acute and chronic health effects of particulate matter. And the first couple are basically just due to the sheer overloading of the respiratory system, such as increased asthma or increased allergies, and then cardiovascular problems because increased risk of heart attack, stroke due to inflammation of the lungs, the overloading of the lungs' ability to process and remove the dust and do the gas exchange of oxygen and CO2. Also increased risk of blood clotting. There are some chemicals that are released because of dust that lead to, that I've seen articles that may lead to increased blood clotting. And then things, the next ones on the list on this page and the next are things that might react from, result from the chemical interactions of the dust between, with the fluids along various exposure pathways. So physical or chemical irritation of the respiratory GI tract and eyes or skin. There are diseases from contained pathogens, such as valley fever. It's caused by a soil fungus, Coccidioides immitis. Anthrax is caused by a soil pathogen, Bacillus anthracis. Pneumoconioses, basically fibrotic diseases of the lungs, such as silicosis, asbestosis, coal workers' pneumoconiosis, secondary congestive heart failure, because it becomes a lot harder for the heart to pump the blood essentially the overloading and the scarring of the lung makes it much more difficult, puts stress on the heart, increased susceptibility to pathogens, for example, like tuberculosis, then various cancers, mesothelioma, toxicity from uptake of bioaccessible heavy metals and organic chemicals is very strongly suspected in some cases in leading to toxicity not only in the lungs but to places elsewhere in the body that to which those toxicants can be transported. So the toxicity effects depend on the exposure pathway. Is it inhalation, ingestion, dermal exposure, or through the eyes? The dose, the intensity, and the duration of the exposure. Personal factors like age, genetics, smoking versus non-smoking, general health and nutritional status. And then this is where we see the role for the earth scientists in helping understand the role of particle characteristics. And there are a couple of papers that that we've talked about that start summarizing this as well. So just to show you really quickly, particle size and shape do matter. Essentially, if you inhale particles, there's a particle size fractionation that's going on from high to deep in the lungs. Basically, as people have talked about, only the fraction around 2.5 microns or smaller reaches into the deepest alveoli. A lot of the coarser particles are trapped on the mucus lining the respiratory tract, and the cilia lining the tract bring it up, and you either cough it, spit it out, or swallow it. And so, again, particles generally in the 7 to 10, maybe a little bit higher range, reach into the upper nasal part and then get progressively finer. Now, if people breathe through their mouths, they're going to get a coarser particle load deeper into the respiratory tract. And this is a very complicated slide, but as a geochemist, I like seeing differences in fluid composition because that makes it interesting from a geochemical perspective. But the same particle, depending on whether it is ingested or inhaled, will see a very different suite of chemicals in the body. Or even along the same pathway, like ingestion, the particle first sees very acidic fluids in the stomach and then goes into near-neutral pH fluids.
and also the complexing agents like amino acids and other things change according to the exposure pathway as well. So that's a very interesting thing from us, from our perspective as well. I want to point out these alveolar macrophages down here in the alveoli. Those are the white blood cells of the lung. They're designed to go after invading particles, and they're basically designed to digest things like bacteria, things like that. Fibers like asbestos are too long for them to engulf, and so that's one of the problems. Or if you get an overload of particles that are more equant, basically the macrophages can't do their job, and then it becomes a matter of how soluble the particles are in the fluids lining the lung. And so that's why we like to think about these things in a biosolubility, biodurability, and bioreactivity context. Basically, biosoluble particles are those that are soluble in the body's various fluids and can release their contained toxicants. Bioaccessibility is a measure of that. So something that has bioaccessible lead basically means that that lead can be very readily released along the particular exposure pathway and then is available to be absorbed by the body. It doesn't guarantee that it is, but it may be. Bioreactivity, some particles can react with the body's fluids to cause either acute or chronic adverse chemical changes. Caustic tissue damage due to alkalis or acids. Also, there's mention made of bioavailable iron. Iron is one of the things that the toxicologists look at very strongly for its participation in oxidative stress in the body. And so if iron gets dissolved in a big way and the body can't process it, that iron is there then going to participate in redox reactions that could generate reactive oxygen species, which in turn can generate DNA damage. And biodurable minerals like crystalline silica or asbestos are the ones that don't dissolve in the lung environment and will persist in the body for decades, and they can bleed off iron over the decades that would cause long-term reactive oxygen species generation, or their particle surfaces can react as well. So they can have chronic bioreactivity. So as a result of this, we're trying to talk about how we can sort of bridge the gap between the disciplines. And geotoxicology is essentially the study of the toxicological characteristics and potential health effects of earth materials, such as geogenic and geoanthropogenic particulate matter. And it's best accomplished collaboratively by earth and health scientists, we think. Now, when I give my talk, I've had a colleague in the earth science realm who doesn't necessarily prescribe to the precautionary principle that a lot of the public health people prescribe to. And he says, gee, Jeff, when I hear your talk, it makes me not want to go out of the house and breathe anything because I think everything I'm breathing in is going to hurt me. And I first say kind of jokingly, well, if you knew what was in the dust in your house, you might want to go outside, but based on what they've been finding about what's in house dust. But then I also try to stress that essentially what we're trying to do is provide needed chemical, mineralogical, and other kinds of earth science ground truthing that will help assess whether a lot of issues that have been raised as concerns actually truly are. So it's a good way for health earth scientists to help understand the magnitude of an issue associated with a particular health risk. So there's a whole spectrum of geotoxicology can include a whole spectrum of different methods ranging from the earth sciences on the top to biomedical. And there's roles for both earth and health scientists throughout that spectrum. Like we can help understand the sources of potential contaminants like asbestos-bearing rocks. We can characterize the materials, whether there are toxicants in them. We can do physiologically based extraction tests using simulated body fluids to look at to model bioaccessibility. And then the earth scientists can actually provide needed characterization for things like in vivo toxicity testing using rats or feeding soils of known lead mineralogy to pigs to look at lead uptake, looking at cell toxicity testing using petri dishes to assess short-term toxicity, and then looking at geologic databases to help understand epidemiology, looking at pathology samples to characterize changes in particles that have occurred once exposure has happened, and then helping interpret biomonitoring data as well. So I'm going to give you sort of a tour of a very quick whirlwind tour, so to speak, of various types of particulate matter to show what some of the issues might be. Urban particulate matter is what the public health people have focused on the most. Combustion products, you can see the spheres are residual oil fly ash particles. There's a lot of finer particles. We found this is a standard that was collected by NIST in the 1970s, very, very high in lead. Hopefully, if that same thing were to be collected these days, it would be a lot lower in lead. But what we also found was it was very high in bioaccessible chromium, arsenic, vanadium, cadmium, and a whole variety of other potential heavy metals. So a lot of focus has been on lead, and lead has decreased, but there are other metals as well. An extreme and hopefully never repeated case of urban particulate matter, the dust generated by the World Trade Center. We have four papers and an ACS special volume if you're interested, looking at characterization. But the main thing is there, you see it's kind of a dog's breakfast of stuff. And there's chrysotile asbestos, there's in a couple of percent, 40% glass wool fibers. Those are the long fiber things you see. There are glass shards from window glass, and perhaps most importantly, there are levels of metals like lead and antimony, and also there's concrete particles. Concrete has calcium hydroxide. When a little bit of that comes in contact with a lot of water, it generates caustic alkalinity, which is one of the things that they noted with people that were exposed to the dust. They had burning eyes, burning nose, gastroesophageal reflux, and things like that. Asbestos, the last 10 years have sort of seen a huge change, sea change in what's looked at asbestos. Previously, the focus was mostly on commercial or industrial asbestos and occupational exposures and maybe some environmental exposures to things, to asbestos used commercially. But because of Libby, Montana, which is a vermiculite mine with high levels of fibrous amphiboles that had very high levels of asbestos-related disease, the asbestos was a natural contaminant of the vermiculite. There's been sort of a change in perspective saying that we got to start looking at what people are calling naturally occurring asbestos or geologic asbestos that is liberated. It's not mined commercially. It is there as part of the rocks and is brought into the environment by either mining or just by regular erosion activities or things like that. Also in California, for example, a lot of attention being paid to naturally occurring asbestos. This is a serpentinite quarry. Typically has a lot of chrysotile and some tremolite asbestos, and here's a house with some people living there. So what are the concerns? Are there health risks associated with living near quarries that are producing dust? And this is a very important issue that is going to be driving a lot of policy decisions at the local level, where these geologic units occur that have high levels of asbestos. There's also a huge amount that earth scientists can do in helping understand toxicity of asbestos that I don't have time to get into. So if you're interested in asbestos, that's something that I will be happy to talk with you about after the talk. We've been doing a lot of work lately on wildfires, particularly the urban wildland interface. The San Diego area got huge amounts of fire in 2007. This is from last year, the Station Fire in September, very near L.A. That's the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Same picture of the same fire from the L.A. Times. So what are the issues? Well, there's smoke, there's airfall ash left behind after the fire. There are a variety of organic compounds like PAHs, dioxins, flame retardants, other combustion byproducts that could possibly be there, heavy metals, soil particles entrained in the plume. And then possibly post-fire exposures to pathogens in the soils that were exposed by the burning. Human health concerns, there are concerns for the wildfires as well. You see firefighters' health up in smoke. These guys are starting to do this on a year-round basis now. And you can see most of them are just wearing bandanas and not much more, and they're in pretty thick smoke. You see here the downwind people. A few of them are wearing dust masks, but the issues of smoke, and we're also seeing this probably has some airfall ash in it as well. And this can actually extend a long distance. This is the newspaper article. Basically, the Station Fire led to health advisories in Colorado because of the higher levels of particulate matter, essentially causing problems potentially for asthmatics and other people that are predisposed to respiratory problems. And then during cleanup, these are the guys that do it professionally. They're wearing the right kind of gear, but how many times, in spite of the warnings from the public health departments, do you see people wearing shorts and T-shirts and no respiratory protection going back in and cleaning up their houses? I feel bad for them, very much so, but again, this is a case where they're probably getting exposed to a lot of different things in the ash. Now, is it a long enough or a high enough dose to be a problem? Hopefully not. So the ash types that we've looked at, wildland residual white and black. The black has a higher level of charcoal. It's not as completely combusted. The white ash is much higher level of combustion, much more completely combusted. This is the stuff that actually becomes very well airborne. It's just light, fluffy stuff. Residential ash and debris can have quite a bit of white ash because it looks to us like the residences tend to burn hotter because of all their combustion stuff in them. And then we're now starting to look at airfall ash deposits downwind in areas that haven't burned, but it's ash that the burning fires have picked up and carried downwind. The white ash characteristics, a very high proportion is respirable, and that's fairly significant. And also a lot of it's actually in an ingestible range from through hand-to-mouth contact. And so what we see, this is a plot, we do a one-part water to 20-part, or one-part ash to 20-part water leachate and measure the alkalinity and the pH. And the on the left, our unburned soils, then going up to burned soils, and then wildland ash, residential ash, and then white ash in the pink. The airfall ash can actually, and so here is pH 10.5. That's the difference between non-caustic and caustic alkalinity. Essentially, this is measuring the extent of combustion. So you can see here the white ash particles generate very caustic pHs, and some of the airfall ash, which people are breathing downwind, can actually be very caustic as well. And when you do these same tests with simulated lung fluids that have much higher buffering capacity, you can actually still see very strong shifts in pH. So this is one potential issue from a health perspective. Again, that's always been known, but it's an issue of caustic damage due to the alkalis in the ash. Bulk composition of things such as lead, again, we go from the least combusted to the most. And in the vegetation, you can actually see lead is diminishing greatly with increasing combustion. So it's being volatilized, which is good for the residual ash, but it's bad for basically it's stuff getting dispersed downwind. But if you look at the residential ash in blue, can have very high levels of lead from combustion of lead paint and solder and all the other stuff that's in houses that has lead. Electronics, things like that. If we look at chromium the same way, we see the same sort of trend that in the vegetation, chromium tends to decrease, but look at all the chromium that's in the residential ash, and we know for sure that some of that is hexavalent. Some of it is coming from hexavalent chromium in products, but also chromium can combust and in fires to form, go from trivalent or metallic chromium to hexavalent. And we actually see that in our simulated body fluid leaches, where we can see hexavalent chromium measurable, and it actually persists for long times in these organic-rich fluids. So, again, this is a case where exposure to chromium-rich ash might be a potential exposure pathway for hexavalent chromium that the public health people would want to take a look at. The other thing that's really interesting is valley fever. In 2003, there was an uptick in valley fever, which is, again, caused by the soil fungus Coccidioides imidus. And that basically is a soil fungus that lives in certain parts of it's endemic to Southern California. There has been some thought that it's associated with these marine shale units or marine sands and other sediments. And this, I don't know if you can see these white dots, but these are the places where they had outbreaks of valley fever or cases of valley fever following the Northridge earthquake, which released dust clouds from these Eocene marine units. So if you look at the area that was burned in 2003, it's over the exact same area. So, again, this is a case where the combustion has tended to release has taken off the ability of the ground to hold down the dust, and so there's a lot higher dust generation and things like that. So with that, I think what I'll do, there are a number of other potential sources like dry lake beds. There's desert dusts. The burn pit picture that I showed you in the beginning of the troops burning stuff in these pits in Iraq and Afghanistan, that's an awfully dusty environment. And so we would argue, and a lot of that's coming from geogenic or geoanthropogenic mineral dust. So the question is the fact that they're already in a very dusty condition, does that change how they can respond to the smoke that they're being exposed to in the burn pits? So again, this is a case where earth scientists working with health scientists can actually go provide information on what sorts of things are people being exposed to, and then how might they be reacting in the body, And are those reactions potentially leading to toxicity? So it's part of a spectrum of things that involve earth scientists all the way through toxicologists, cellular biologists, pulmonary specialists, and the like. So with that, I hope I've given you a little bit of a flavor. If you're interested in some of the other things, we've looked at a lot of other different types of particulate matter. I'd be happy to talk with you afterwards, but I'll entertain a question if that's okay. Plenty of time. Thanks.
Now we're going to break to our discussants. We have two discussants. First is Dan Jaffe from the University of Washington, and our second discussant, contrary to what it says in the program, Chris Wilson wasn't able to make it, but Nick Lancaster is going to step in his place. So, Dan, you want to start out here? Yeah, why don't you come on up? You got a microphone up here, so.
Okay, great section of presentations. I think we can give another round of applause for all of our speakers. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening. This concludes the session. For information regarding other sessions in this series, please call AVON at 1-800-810-TAPE.